And so you kind of have to say to yourself, is the need for it to be absolute and perfect more about my need for certainty than actually about whether it is or not?
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Free Radical Podcast. Today I've met a dear friend, fellow Gaudiya Vaishnava thinker and filmmaker, Ravi Chambers. Ravi spent most of his 20s living as a monk, immersed in the practices and philosophy of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Now a multi-award winning filmmaker and founder of Be Inspired Films, he continues to explore the sacred through his story, not in robes, but behind the camera. With over 30 years of experience around the tradition, Ravi brings a rare mix of reverence and inquiry, unafraid to ask difficult questions, but rooted in a deep love for the path. His work frequently focuses on social impact, education, and amplifying the voices of those often left out of the narrative. Ravi's journey from mantra to movie set is less a departure and more a continuation, a different kind of service through storytelling. He believes that stories have the power not just to inform, but to transform, and how we tell them shapes our spiritual life more than we often realize. So today's meeting was exactly about that, storytelling. And we embrace the concept in from different perspectives, speaking about institutions and guides, the need for over-idealization, faith, different stages of the journey. I mean, we touch upon so many themes and topics of our life through the lenses of storytelling, the story we tell ourselves, the underlying main myth and stories sustaining the whole of reality, how to deal with inherited stories we receive from our particular tradition. In one sense, I'm supposed to be the host of the podcast, but I really love the dynamics of the podcast, and he himself has his own interviews done with other people. So somehow it was very dynamic at times I felt being hosted by him in the conversation, which I really appreciate. It was a very beautiful, candid, intimate conversation between two friends. Brothers, that's all it is. Nothing less, nothing more, but there's a lot there. So this is the Free Radical Podcast. To support it, as usual, you are invited to subscribe to the channel, clicking on the bell. If you feel nourished, inspired by the conversation, you can like it, you can share it, you can share your comments with us to keep this conversation live, vibrant, and ongoing. Without further ado, dear brothers, sisters, dear universal family, here is Ravi Chambers. So, dear Ravi, thanks so much for joining us in the Free Radical Podcast. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. It's really nice to be here. I'm looking forward to the chat, and it's nice to see you.
So what brings you here today to this conversation? I always love to ask my guests, why here today?
Well, we made a connection some time back. I really appreciate your curiosity, your broad-mindedness, your non-judgmental approach to, you know, bhakti or the spiritual path. It's something that I feel speaks to me more and more as I'm older, and I always am really happy to have conversations with devotees who or people on a path who I can speak freely and openly with, and who speak like that with me. So I'm really, that's why I'm here.
Thank you. Probably that's why I'm here, exactly for the same reasons in regards to you. So I appreciate your contribution as well. And it seems that today we want to concentrate on the concept of storytelling, probably. So I think it's a very unique, I love the idea. It's a great idea, because you yourself, of course, are a storyteller, you're a filmmaker. I will maybe argue in one way or another, we are all storytellers. We are all trying to tell our story, though we may not be aware of that, and we may need to become aware of that. And I like to think, yeah, across traditions, across cultures, I mean, storytelling is, in my opinion, how we make meaning of our world, how we make sense of reality from the narratives of the Puranas to the biblical parables. And in Buddhist, they have their own tales and their indigenous oral traditions. And in our postmodern current culture, I mean, all of them are, I won't call stories as mere entertainment, but as a way to, again, articulate and making sense of reality. And probably we remember the stories way more than we may remember the sermons and the preaching.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I thought it might be a nice framing to kind of have a broad discussion, but with that kind of a lens, because I do agree. Stories for me, we've got the personal stories are how you make sense of things. Like, I love that phrase, meaning making, you know, because things happen, so many things happen. And I think the stories, there's two different types of stories, though, because there's obviously the stories we hear that are passed down. And that could just be, you know, in a culture. It could also be in a broader body of kind of spiritual teachings. And I guess I'm really curious as to how we interface with those stories. Like, are they absolute? As in, I think the subject matter that they're about can certainly be absolute, but the stories in and of themselves and the details in the stories. So are they absolute? Is there room for interpretation? Is there something about what the stories are supposed to elicit within us that maybe is the thing? Or is it the story itself in the facts and details within it? And I think if we look at our own personal story, so I know many times the story isn't always clear from the beginning. You know, a personal story can evolve. And I guess what I mean by evolve is that it becomes clearer the more you kind of discuss it and talk about it and debate it and live it. Then every so often, I hope everyone will have this experience, something you kind of go, oh, now that makes sense to me. It could have been something that had already happened, but we couldn't see maybe why it happened or the context of how it has meaning for us straight away. So it's a kind of an evolving thing. So I'm really fascinated, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on sometimes it feels like the nature of stories that have been passed down is like, this is the story and there's nothing more. There's no mystery to it. Like, it's sort of, it's here it is and now it's complete and that's it. And I wonder if that's underselling the power that story could have if we were a bit more open or curious with it.
Well, I'm totally in with the journey you are proposing in this conversation, Ravi, and thinking about, as you say, stories as what's the absoluteness of the story, what's the relativeness of the story, so to say, and how much when we receive or inherit a story, whether in a spiritual tradition, whether sometimes in your family system, there is a narrative underlying the lineage and how much we can see an underlying more absolute pattern in the teaching, in the essence, and how much the details are something else. Or as you say, how much when we hear a story, like, for example, both of us we have a shared spiritual background in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, and there are lots of stories. And how much the stories, as you say, the official script, the official definition of the story, how much we can take a story literally. I like to think in these three ways. Like, you can take stories or sections in the scripture as literal things. There are a literal reading, there is an interpretative reading, and there could be a more esoteric and even participatory reading. Like, in the beginning, you just take what it says, it's the facts, it says this. The second one is more metaphorical, symbolic, interpretive. Okay, this story actually speaks to me in this way, conveys this lesson, has this symbol. We may go there in a minute, symbol, a myth in stories.
Yeah.
And then deeply, it's like to see yourself participating in what story, in that story is telling in your own unique way. It's not just only like a intellectual way of drawing an idea that applies to you, but you are actually You became a part of the stories in your own unique way, right? So
yeah,
I see all those layers of reading a story or a text or a scripture are for me available, legal, and probably depending on our level of maturity on the journey, we may also relate to stories from different places. So I'm saying that to also normalize and not stigmatize the literalists, so to say, but also not to stigmatize the other ones.
Yes. It's interesting that, and I don't want to get too distracted on it, but it brings up an idea I was discussing with someone recently. If the majority body of people who are policing what way of reading the stories is correct and isn't correct, let's say, are not so mature. In our tradition, sometimes they could be called like this idea of a kanishta, like a very literalist, a very not very mature understanding. I was just thinking, if a society or a community is predominantly, may not be predominantly made up of people like that, but if the ones that are the loudest that kind of police or judge what is or isn't bona fide, then, and they decide that the literal version is the only bona fide one, then actually you are destined to have a society which only has kanishtas in the society, because the other people will get pushed out. And that is a very interesting and somewhat scary concept.
I agree. I hear you. I hear. That's why I will say, ideally, at least in a traditional sense, we see all these ancient cultures and tradition having their elders, like leading the society, we may call in terms of brahmanas or elders, wise sages, which are not just older, but elder, right? So there is a maturity, a life experience that is, you draw your lessons, you learn to read, again, life and reality, not from merely a literalist lenses. Mm. So those guys are the ones who are guiding reality, guiding society, sorry. Even if there are a few, but they are putting everyone else in context, so to say. But if we don't have that, I totally agree how the masses may be confused, distracted, or not receiving the proper perspective. And that's why I remember concluding my second book, Radical Personalism, and speaking about the urgency and why we need elders, you know, how important it is to have, even if there are a few, but those figures will help the rest to... the rest who are not elders to somehow remain on track and remain with some proper perspective that eventually takes them to become elders. Because if not, it doesn't warrant it, just a mere passing of time and makes elderhood, so to say.
Yeah. I mean, this is also something that my friend and I were discussing. It's like, it's funny nowadays when you hear on the internet, there in popular culture, there's sometimes debates about different things, and they are always very careful to say allegedly. If we don't have all of the picture, we say allegedly. But so I'm going to preface what I'm saying is that it appears to me, because obviously I don't know, it appears to me that a lot of the elders or senior people who are, for whatever reason, still very much at the core of the organization, do not appear to mirror or to talk about. So my friend and I were talking about a stage of our spiritual life that we felt we were at, and many other people certainly other people that we know are feeling and thinking certain similar things. And we were just wondering, why is it that what we're thinking does not appear to be being ever addressed or talked about? And so we were kind of joking a little bit, but we were thinking, are we maturing, or are we just leaving as such? Like, are we kind of, so how do we make meaning of what's happening to us? Are we maturing, which we would hope is what's happening? Or are we there was a sort of a phrase in the original days of sometimes of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, that if you are falling away from the strict rigid idea of it, that you're blooping or you're leaving, you're just sort of fading out. So which one is it? Now, the wishful thinking is that, of course, we're trying to mature. But I would hesitate. I would say that certainly some people from the more rigid perspective would disagree. And so we were trying to understand, is the reason that it's not being talked about by the elders or the leaders because they're not going through it themselves? Because you'd imagine they were going through it themselves. They've been doing it for such a long time. They must be maturing. Or is it because they need to appeal to this mass group who perhaps aren't there yet? And so that's why they're not speaking about it. I don't know if you have any reflections on it, but it does appear to be very unusual because, like I said, otherwise what you get is always only this group of kind of immature people.
Yeah, those are complex dynamics, of course, because, of course, especially when we speak about big groups or big organizations, and maybe, and with this again, we're not pointing to one group and taking it, making it personal. There are different groups and different big organizations in everywhere. But I'm thinking in any big group, and especially if the group is focused on making the big group even bigger
and new people.
Yeah, and getting new people, which again, I'm not condemning. I'm just saying everything has its price to pay. So
yeah,
if you have a big group and you're concerned with keeping the influx of newcomers, so to say, and that's the main emphasis and the main story that you, that it's being shared, somehow that has, again, that something is compromised in the way of that, unless and until there are special arrangements made for those who are not the newcomers, not the the ones that just arrived, those who need a deeper culture, a deeper refinement, and there are particular departments organized for that, and everything is put into context, and even the newcomers are educated in the way that points with a long, middle, short, middle, long-term goal of how do we make the newcomers into elders, right? Yes. It's not just like, let's keep the numbers increasing and the people entering, because as we talked many times with different people, you can have lots of influx, but also you can have lots of outflux.
Which definitely
happens. If we are not nourishing those who are already there, right? So,
yeah.
And again, I'm not saying it's an easy thing, especially when you have big groups. And that's why many times, and I'm not saying that's what should happen, but many times that's what needs to happen, is that big things need to collapse into smaller bits that are more personal and more specific into the necessity of each particular case. I always like to think about, I don't know, some of these great universities that are renowned for their education system, like Oxford and Cambridge, and many of them, their method is one-on-one, right? The teacher doesn't have like 3,000 students. It may have 5, 7, but it spends lots of time with each one, you know, which warrants the quality of the future student, which will be a future teacher, and so on. So so in terms of parampara, if we want to think like succession, teacher, disciple, student, I will say, in my personal opinion, I see that as more sustainable in time and preserving the quality of the transmission, the quality of the storytelling, to not lose sight of our main theme, because still is we are telling a story to people and to society. So again, I'm not against big groups and sharing. It's not my my personal cup of tea, but I can understand how it's the cup of tea of many, and how big organizations and groups make people feel, I belong, I'm part of something big, and so much is going on, and I'm excited, and I can be engaged, and there can be lots of things being facilitated. But again, everything has its pros and cons, right?
So, yeah. That's a really good point. And I know I agree wholeheartedly, and I think it is worth mentioning again, that all of this exploration, sometimes people can think it's being critical. It certainly, there's no intention for it to be critical. It's more of an analysis. And I think there's great value in it, really, for anyone who wants to think about it, because so many lessons and things can be learned from this kind of thinking about things, especially observing something for a long time. And seeing some of these things has great value. I was thinking when you were chatting there, by the nature of, I heard something on a podcast recently that in education, all of the research, you know, into pedagogy and all the different ways that you can do different things. Certainly there's some incremental increases in or advantages to certain approaches, but the only one apparently from research that has a really significant impact on outcomes is when education is one-to-one. Mm. Huge difference.
Yeah.
And of course, before we look at the modern context, where, you know, we have these big organizations and bigger groups, the idea of the guru or the teacher is very local. Mm. It's very small. I mean, of course, there are some great, from what I understand from the stories, there might be a great traveling, you know, acharya, whatever comes mm-hmm. through. And they may even, you know, give, you know, the Harinam or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. encourage someone to chant. But I, from my understanding, they would expect then that they'll connect with a local person because they're going to leave tomorrow or whenever, you know, and they're gone. And so the idea that a local guru may have, you know, a handful or maybe 100 or something disciples would have been more normal. And I wonder if in bigger numbers, when you have to communicate to bigger numbers, maybe there is a need to dumb down, is one way of calling it, or simplify the story. Mm. Because you need to kind of, you need to get the story to land with a lot of people mm-hmm. quite quickly.
Yeah. And probably you don't know the people.
Well, you don't know them. So
you have to throw a more generic story that you kind of, okay, I think this will fit the masses.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, so that, like you say, the pros and cons, I think that's a very good way to look at it. It is to be aware, if I'm taking a certain approach, there will be pros, but there will also be cons.
Yeah.
When I made my documentary about the girls' education, mm. and they were, one thing we found was that people might think that, oh, you know, the patriarchy is the men. Mm-hmm. The patriarchy is just the established system of power. Mm-hmm. And often there's a role that the women play in the patriarchy, which is equally controlling.
Mm-hmm.
Because within any hierarchy or bigger construct, if that's the predominating construct, everyone, whoever you are, needs to figure out, how do I align myself with the construct for survival
mm-hmm.
or for meaning within the group?
Mm-hmm.
And so unfortunately, then I can understand sometimes in these bigger groups, if you do want to stick around in the more formal aspect of the society, you will probably end up aligning yourself with the power structures of that society, even if you are an elder, which then curtails your ability or your impetus or likelihood of telling stories that don't align with that bigger power narrative. And so that's perhaps maybe where we get these elders or older people who maybe might have gone on some of this journey that we're talking about, but for whatever reason, either keep it private or mm-hmm. push it aside for the other story that was, I need to exist within this structure and this is how I'm going to do it.
Mm.
Possibly. Yeah. And that all that you mentioned is so much connected with our sense of identity also, right? Because we construct an idea of who you are based on, yeah, who I am in the system, so to say. What's my role? What I'm doing? And if that's no longer there, then who I am? Recently, I was listening a short excerpt from one of Namrasa Prabhu's podcasts with an elder in the society he belongs to in ISKCON.
Uh-huh.
And he's a sannyasin, he's a guru, and he was in if we want to speak, in a power position as a GVC, that is like an influential position of hierarchy, if we want to speak in institutional terms, not criticizing mm-hmm. that. And he mm-hmm. eventually let go of that. He felt like, okay, it's time to release that identity, if you will, also that position, and go to the next part of the story. And he will speak with other peers of him in terms of age. And many of them were like terrified about what he was doing about and about their own prospect of seeing themselves doing that. Like, but what would I do if I stop having that position, that influence, that engagement, that those dynamics? And it's not that we are saying they were bad people. It's just that even inadvertently, even unconsciously, without any bad intention, you just start to construct a sense of self that depends on power structures, many times patriarchal structures, hierarchical, over-hierarchical. You end up being casually, without even wanting, probably being on the top of that hierarchy. So maybe isolating yourself in a bubble at the top of the pyramid. And at one point, you can no longer release that because that's who you are. So releasing that will basically entail annihilation, like stopping existing. Not literally, but that's how we'll take it, no? So
yeah, definitely. And it is uncomfortable. I mean, I know you've shared very much about your journey with it. And I've, over the last however many, 4 or 5 years, been feeling it. Like, it, on one hand, it's irresistible because it, if especially if you feel compelled to follow the path that feels honest and true to you, then you can't help but endeavor to follow that path. But at the same time, it is somewhat terrifying because for such a long time, and this is back to the stories that often we embraced as a younger person or a person earlier on the spiritual path, is the sense of certainty is so appealing. It's so appealing because in a world that can be confusing, that can be painful, that can be uncertain, this idea that so I have thought of this idea of the idea of a life raft. You know, if you're in the ocean and you come across a life raft and you're holding on to it, it's so appealing. Why would you let it go? I mean, it would be madness in one sense.
Yeah.
And the thing is that everyone, regardless, they don't have to be on a spiritual path. Everyone has their version of the life raft. So whatever it is, so it could be their money or success or family or whatever, it doesn't really matter. But the point is that we kind of all have a sense that there's so much uncertainty that there's something that we need to hold on to that makes us feel safe and secure. So yeah, to kind of involuntary or even more so voluntarily kind of start to let go of that, it is terrifying. And you can see why a lot of people don't do it.
Yeah. As much as I love to speak about uncertainty and the unknown and paradox and doubt, they have a whole chapter in my book about that. And I really found so many treasures in my own life journey, being thrown into those spaces for so many times. Of course, at the same time, I try to hopefully balance my presentation, acknowledging the need for some certainty, because if everything is uncertain, that's too much. And of course, if everything is pure, sheer certainty, that's its own problem again, right? So I always like to think in terms of that. Some time ago, I received this illustration, three circles. So the inner circle was the comfort zone. The next circle was the learning zone. And the next circle was the panic zone. Right, so the idea is to stay in the in between, right? Because if you stay too much there as inside, it's like as an insider even of your tradition, and just over-identify with your tradition and praising your tradition and not having any way of any critical thinking, everything is perfect, and criticizing everyone outside your tradition, minimizing everyone else but maximizing and over-glorifying your tradition, that's still too much of an insider. Richard Rohr will like to say, I identify myself as living on the edge of the inside.
I wrote that on my piece of paper right now. I read an amazing article called that. I love that idea.
Yeah, not on the very center of the inside, because it makes me lose sight of what's going on everywhere else. But I'm not outside. I'm not an outsider throwing rocks, criticizing with cynicism and bitterness and resentment. I'm an insider. I'm committed. Mm-hmm. And because I love my tradition, as I mentioned in my book, I dare to criticize my tradition because I love it. Right.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So again,
and you want it to be all that it could be, not just for new people, but for people like yourself at every stage. Like, it's almost like you want to see it grow up. If you had a child, or, you know, for the same things that you love the child for as a baby, if the baby is 26 or 30 years old acting like a baby, nobody likes it. It's terrible.
It may be a monster, probably. You're breathing a monster. But for the growing to happen, you need to expose your child to outside of the comfort zone, which is outside of your comfort zone as a parent, uncertainty, potential danger, but it's required for growth. There is no other way around, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you see it with, I don't mean to sound kind of sensationalist, but you sort of see it with psychopaths. Like, perhaps it's because somebody has been, like their parent has been telling them, oh, if anything happens or somebody says something to you or whatever, they're the bad guy. You're just fine as you are. You don't have to change. You just stay exactly like you are. Whatever your ideas are, even if the world is telling you, sending you so many messages that this is not a way to behave or to think, oh, don't listen to them. They don't know anything. You actually are just fine like you are. Good. And like sometimes in the movies, you'll see it like it's the mother telling the son, you know, like, oh, you're okay. You know, but she's actually not helping him. She's hurting him so badly by making him believe that he doesn't need to grow and learn and change. Like you say, otherwise he turns into a monster.
And you're setting like the person for an ultra victim pattern, right? Like, because you're okay like you are. Everyone is bad. So whatever happens, you are not bad. So you are, if something bad happens, it's not your fault. It's always
never your fault.
So you're always a victim. You're always a victim. So whenever something bad happens, and it will happen, you are not equipped to deal with that because everyone is bad. I'm the victim. And you just over-identify with that. And maybe you heard about these drama triangles that many times those who over-identify as a victim end up being the perpetrator, and they shift roles to the rescuer. And all those three are somehow toxic patterns, like victim, perpetrator, and rescuer. Instead of the rescuer, you should become a teacher. Instead of a perpetrator, you should become a healthy challenger. Instead of a victim, you should become, if you go through something, I don't want to deny it, I don't want to sound insensitive, some people may have gone through abuse, trauma, victims, but at the same time, we have to acknowledge the victimhood, support them, nourish them, but also make them survivors.
Not just victims forever,
And I like to see that as like, okay, you're a victim. Okay, we are all victims in many ways. We have to become survivors of whatever we have gone through. And from a proper survivor perspective, we have to become heroes, right?
Yeah.
Then I feel bad going to this idea of storytelling and the famous hero's journey of Joseph Campbell, right? Like,
very famous.
It also begins with leaving the familiar, going back to uncertainty, right? Leaving the familiar, being confronting with the dragon of the unknown, the shadows, gaining your wisdom, and going back home with transformed eyes, right? Yeah.
And the beautiful thing about that is obviously oversimplified in movies and stuff, but is that it doesn't just happen once. It happens again and again and again. So there's always new dragons and new challenges and new teachers as well. You know, if you think of it like that, you're not necessarily always going to go back to the same teacher. Because the same teacher may or may not be able to help you with the new dragon, or may not have experience, or so on. So that's the thing that's challenging about this idea of having, I sometimes use the phrase of the idea of having arrived. I'll share with you some of the phrases that made me feel as a young man like I had arrived.
Okay.
So one is, this is the king of all knowledge. It's the end of all knowledge. There's nothing else to know, right? So that's a phrase. So it's in one sense a very beautiful idea. You know, it's, mm-hmm. it, you know, but it can equally be seen or interpreted in a way which means that I don't need to, like, I've arrived now. Like, there's nothing more for me to know. No. I may only be 22 years old, but I can just, you know, loudly, like, I remember being on a train in India. And, you know, in India, there's kind of like a booth, I suppose. You've got a bench on each side and the bench above that people can sleep on. And it's quite crowded. So there's a lot of people there. And it was an Indian man. And I was in my robes and everything, you know. And he was talking, started to talk about Bhagavad Gita. And maybe he was presenting some idea that was different from the stories I'd heard. And I was having a full-on argument with the guy, telling him he was a mudha, he was an ass, that he was such a, you know, nonsense and all of this. I'm just some little kid who's barely, like,
it's read fine. This, you know, it's legal for, it's legal for that time. You have a license to be fanatic for some.
Maybe it's a rites of passage to go through, but looking back, you know, it's quite embarrassing because, but I was emboldened in my confidence because of the idea, the stories that I had read that made me think, oh, I've been searching. When I was a teenager, I was searching, and now I found it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't just find an interesting path or a good path. I didn't just find a path that, you know, could be helpful to me. Mm-hmm. I found the absolute topmost path above all other paths. What are the odds, you know? Like, you know, and I, you know, I genuinely thought to myself, I'm so fortunate I found that. And now, many years later, I often kind of jokingly say, what are the chances that there are, you know, maybe, who knows, but probably hundreds of thousands of groups who think the exact same thing? Exactly the same thing. Okay, maybe they have different books and they can reference. They'll have their stories. They'll have their this person and they quote this, and they'll have a very well formulated argument for it. And, you know, and so you kind of have to say to yourself, is the need for it to be absolute and perfect more about my need for certainty than actually about whether it is or not?
Amen, brother. I don't want to sound what I've said now as a trailer and promotion of my own self, but the third book that I'm about to publish in a month or something, I assume you will love it because it's very much related to what you just said. The book is called Evolution and Divine Love, and the subtitle is The Eternal Becoming of God, Soul, and Matter, even. So it's all about changing our perspective of, again, absoluteness and conclusiveness and finish end point, dead end. I know it all. I have it figured out, certainty, but an opening to, okay, I'm dealing with the infinite here. There's mystery. There is unfolding. There is ongoing newness and ever freshness. And for me, that's what keeps not only the spiritual life exciting, but life as meaningful, because if not, it becomes so stagnant, like, and it's so contradictory to speak about I know it all and we are still dealing with the infinite, right? So
yes,
and you say so many interesting things. I like to touch a few of them because I really appreciated them. For example, you were saying this, we were talking a few minutes ago about the hero's journey, and you mentioned how the hero's journey doesn't happen only once, right? It's like revisiting and many times, not only in terms of finding new teachers that help us in different lessons. That's one option. Another option is the same teacher is not the same person always. So you, both student and teacher, continue to walk together and change and be transformed in the journey, which for me is a journey of, I will call it, perpetual arrival, as you were saying about arrival, right? It's not just I got here, nothing else, but it's a further arrival. It's continuing to arrive, right?
Yeah,
and also for me, this going on again on a journey. Sometimes I've seen practitioners thinking, "Oh, after 20 years of practicing, I feel myself being the same situation or dealing with the same issue." But at the same time, you are not the same. So in that sense, it's not that you are going in circles and there's no real progress. I would like to more think in terms of spiral. So you are going in circles, but the circles are expanding. They're getting wider. So it's never the same place, right? So, yeah. And that's how I will explain that. You referred for a moment to this idea of this verse from the Bhagavad Gita 9:2, Raja Vidya Raja Guhyam, right? This is the king of knowledge. So for me, it's interesting how Krishna himself qualifies his own words. First expression, this is the king of knowledge. As you say, if you just get that, oh, I got the king of knowledge. I'm the king now or whatever. I know everything. But then immediately he qualifies that and says, Raja Guhyam, which means this is the king of secrets. So yeah. So that throws you into uncertainty because it's a secret. It's a king of secrets in one sense means it will always remain a secret. So that's for me, it's interesting because the first line may lean toward certainty, right? King of knowledge. If I know that, I know everything. And then he nuances that and it's not only a secret, it's a king of secrets. And in that same verse, they say, Pratyaksha Vagamam, you can only understand this by personal experience.
And I love that bit.
A personal experience is always very different, the nuance. And so, yeah, the whole verse put in context really makes a bigger picture, which is very interesting, right?
Yeah, that's beautiful. And thank you for explaining that in that way. Yeah, it's that all stood out to me, that bit at the end, by direct experience. Mm. And by that very nature, that's personal. So you see, oftentimes what we get in the group mentality is that everyone has to see it the same way. Because if we don't see it the same way, then your version of it is, and we all know the phrases, mental speculation, it's because of your ego, it's because of this, it's because of that. Because if the only way that we can know it's not those things is if we all see it exactly the same. But that is actually impersonal. Because if we accept that this wonderful, divine, you know, source of all sources, you know, whatever name you want to call it by, is, you know, by nature, you know, magical, wonderful, you know, sometimes people are so drawn to the impersonal because it's kind of like the idea that it is beyond our realm. So therefore and we also have this in our philosophy, personalism as well, that it is in one sense not perceivable by the mundane senses. It is difficult to try to rationalize or understand or measure or pin down from the experience of this more limited world. But if we're personalists, no, we know everything about that absolute. We know, you know, what he likes to do at midday and exactly what he's got in his lunchbox and all of that, you know. So, but the point is that I think for fear, because there's so much scaremongering about falling into the impersonal understanding, that actually we underestimate just how much it is unknown and just how much it is beyond our possibility to understand. And I think that's such a fine dance, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, wanting to be a personalist, but even if you want to take a personalist approach to the idea that something is beyond, and you know, maybe you don't know exactly what it is, and let's say maybe it's impersonal, or not that it's impersonal, but that we can't pin down the exact details of it, then you can still have a personal approach or desire to have a personal exchange with that, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And I think if that's the case, then you have to allow that's something to unfold between the individual and the supreme. It's a personal, it's a real, it's a thing between each person. And how can anyone dictate what that is?
Again, yeah, totally agree. Personal experience. That's why I'm all for radical personalism.
Yeah.
But that has some price, as you say, right? Like, and sometimes in the name of radical personalism, we become toxically certain about, as you say, details, and we know what's in God's lunchbox and what's the name of his earrings, and we become ultra specific, and that gives this clinging into because I have all this detailed information, whatever, I'm saved or I'm secured or I'm, but information doesn't translate to transformation, right? So at the end of the day, we need to have a personal experience and be transformed by that. And yeah, we are, again, dealing with the infinite. So as I like to say, we have to balance our knowing, whatever we know, we have to balance that with unknowing.
Yeah. You know?
We have to humble our knowing with the perpetual unknowing. I mean, the things we know are always less than the things we don't know. That's this basic principle. And we have to have this, like, so I like to call it epistemological modesty. Like in how we try to know things, how do I know what I know? We have to be modest and humble, because no matter you are a pandit and if you know so much, still, I mean, besides that, again, there is this beyondness and this infiniteness to everything. And even the absolute is personal, but it's also impersonal. I mean, we're not against denying that. It's just,
yeah,
it may not be my cup of tea, but that's part of the absolute. So how to include all that? I mean, our philosophy in particular is bhed avid, right? Which is difference and non-difference. So it invites for nuance. It invites for not one story. Again, like this is the only way, as you started saying, better we all think in the same way, because if not, trouble, dilemma, problem. But that's not our philosophy. Philosophy speaks about, yeah, there is one foundational underlying unity, a center around which everything revolves, but on that foundation, non-dual foundation, there is so much diversity that can and should exist and coexist. So each one of us will have our own experience, and all that should be allowed. You cannot just make one size fits all. Again, then we're back to impersonalism, and it may work. It may work for the kindergarten stage. Okay, give me the formula, what to do, how to think, what to wear, how to wash my hands or any other part of my body in the bona fide way, and how to do everything. What's the bona fide correct way of doing everything? Okay, the formula may last for some time, but at one point you have to outgrow that box and be yourself, basically. It's 100%. Scary, again, because it's, again, leaving the box to enter into a hopefully bigger box and then a bigger box or even no box whatsoever. But that's part of the hero's journey. And again, we need, going back to the idea, elders and guides that support that, because they've gone through that themselves. So they know at one point you will need to go through that yourself. But if me as an elder haven't gone through that, of course I won't see the need for you to go through that, because I have no experience. So I may be even terrified about that. So in my narrative, I will be preventing and canceling all those things. And that's when we have sometimes a collective mess in that sense, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. But in everyday life, how do we navigate it? So for example, one thing I was also discussing with this friend was we had a shared... again, not to want to sound too dramatic, but almost we found it extremely difficult to be around people at this stage in our journey that we're still in that early journey. So let's say you're up a mountain and you're going on a hike and you're with a group of people and you're walking along and, you know, then you get, I don't know, you have to decide whether you're going to have lunch or not. And you just say, oh, shall we stop for lunch? And they go, oh, hang on, I just have to ring my teacher and ask them. Or, you know, like, you know, that's kind of a thing, like every little thing. And you're just thinking, after a while, you know, you can imagine, you might just burst out and go, oh, for God's sake, like, you know, can you just think for yourself? You know, and can become quite impatient. So it's like, it's kind of like it becomes more and more difficult to be in an environment where the majority of people are at a different stage. Now, there's two things to think about that. One is, isn't it an amazing austerity and actually a wonderful service for someone who might be, let's say, we might call it at the Majum or some more evolved stage, to voluntarily put themselves amongst people who are really at that beginning stage, even though it might be frustrating to them, but they voluntarily do it to try to uplift those people. So that's a wonderful thing, right?
Yeah.
Can you imagine Prabhupada when he first, you know, there was the stories he queued up for the bathroom with everybody, he washed the pots with everybody, you know, he was, you know, really... That is not the kind of association he was probably going to have if he just stayed there in Vrindavan talking to, you know, other elders about, you know, whatever nice things. So there's that one way to look at it. But the other side of it is that it's very difficult. And so I'm not strong enough, I'll say for myself, I'm not strong enough. It affects me in a way which really makes me, it actually makes me quite angry and quite like it irritates me a lot. So, and maybe it's because I don't feel like I have a way to change it, or perhaps I don't have a platform, or I don't feel like, because I'm not in a position that they might listen to, that if I was to even share it, whether they'd be interested to listen or not.
Mm-hmm.
So that's partly why I am always happy to come on and have conversations like this, because perhaps in a more formal setting, people might go, okay, well, I might listen to that. And so hopefully there could be something to learn there. But in general, I find it difficult, which means that you get pushed out, which means that then whatever role you might have to play in maybe helping, you know, the others, if everyone like that gets pushed out, then who's left? Like, then, like I say, everyone just stays the same, perhaps.
Yeah, and those who get pushed out, they create their own group, of course.
Yeah.
That's how it happens many times. Okay, we are the pushed out, so we all have this in common, and we feel that's this need, and we will work in that direction. Not like with resentfulness, and again, like creating a Kuru-Pandava dichotomy, but that's sometimes how certain groups or religious branching comes. But going to your point and the difficulty but the need of having elders who are willing to put themselves and be empathic, compassionate, and present with the, let's say, with the less mature ones, and that's, I mean, you're a father yourself, right? You have some kids, so in one level you have to do that. I mean, to be a father, successful, quote unquote, father, healthy father of sorts, we are not perfect, but you cannot treat your 2, 3, 4 year old as a 30, 40 year old. It doesn't work. Your kid will look at you like, huh? So you need to calm down, quote unquote. In one sense, you say calm down, but by you doing that calming down, you're coming up in terms of.
Well, you're having to expand.
Compassion.
I feel like you have to expand yourself.
It's not a coming down in any way, I will say. That's my point. Because sometimes you could see that, as long as we see that as coming down, we may not feel inspired to do that because we feel, oh, I'm coming down. But if you realize, no, I'm growing by doing that. I'm making a sacrifice. I'm increasing my compassion, my empathy. I'm learning from my two-year-old as an adult. So then you start to realize, wow, it's interesting to do that. There's some advantage, if you will, to use that word. I mean, I'm getting some benefit from doing that.
Yeah.
And as much as you can, then by understanding that in that way, you can try to apply that as much as you can in your life. Mm. But yeah, I totally agree that we need people to do that. And everyone has to act according to their adhikar. And for me, that goes back to what you say before, that in ancient times, many times the gurus or the guides who were guiding people one-on-one, they didn't have like thousands of people. Because again, you can only, you have all certain energy and capacity to give yourself and empathize and accompany the journey of the babies in the spiritual life. Mm. I mean, if you are a father, you cannot have like 15 babies at the same time. It's too much. So I will say something like that, even with a guru, even if you're a pure saint, enlightened being, still you only have certain time and energy and capacity to connect with everyone's individual journey and accompany that. And that's why I feel this more reduced in number pattern important and necessary for both to grow, not only for the child, the student to be nourished, but also for the guide, parent, guru to do the work of going down, quote unquote, and experiencing the going up by going down. I think that's humbling for a guide also, and it's protecting the guide if he or she allows himself or herself to engage with those dynamics. Because if not, again, the guru ends up being in a throne, in a bubble, saying a generic thing for thousands, not engaging too personally, not being challenged in those dynamics, not learning from their students, and their students are not getting all the benefits they could get from a more close connection. So, and again, I'm not condemning by these gurus who may have thousands of students, but as you said, in those cases, I will agree it's required to have someone else playing that role in their lives, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting in parenting, there's a phrase that gets used. It's connection before correction.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to need to guide your child or correct them, it's going to be way more effective if you can, you need to connect first, get the trust, you know, sit down with them, play with them, make them feel safe so that they understand. You may know, oh, my advice or my correction is going to come from love, but unless they feel that, then the experience won't be that.
Yeah.
So and it's actually quite it's really important. And I guess that's one thing I wanted to touch on about the idea of legend, because there's stories,
mm-hmm.
and then there's stories that kind of build a legend.
Mm-hmm.
And a legend is a very appealing story, obviously, because it's it fills us with confidence and hope and so many great things that it can fill. And I suppose it kind of comes back. Everything in some respects anchors around this idea of absolute and relative. And we're very scared of relative because we think that if something is relative, that therefore it has no value.
Mm.
We can think that. Mm. And that it can't save us. You know, it doesn't really have any value. But the irony is that if the absolute idea or the legend is not real, then it can be very appealing, but it may not have the effect that you think it will, or it may for some time have the effect that you think it will, but it certainly may have that sort of, I suppose it, you could broadly speaking, you know, put it into the idea of, like, you know, the sort of awe and reverence of something. The depth of the connection can only go so far, whereas you can only really, you know, back to that point about connection before correction, you can only really love and have something real in the imperfection or in the humanness of it. Now this is where for a lot of people it gets very tricky, because they go, well, if we're going to go into the realm of spiritual and God and the representative of God, then it all has to be completely pure, completely perfect, otherwise it's nothing. And it's an all or nothing strategy.
Mm-hmm.
It's an all or nothing strategy, which means you may win big or you may end up with absolutely nothing, because everything you thought it was is not what it was.
Mm.
Or you can almost go in an in-between, which is, this can definitely benefit me. This can help me to evolve. And but it's much more messy and, you know, let's say, it is humble, I suppose, because there's a sort of a humility, like you said, when you talked earlier, I thought two things. I often have felt that, for at least for myself, to be really, to feel humble, I have to know that or acknowledge that I don't know everything. And so I'm a bit humble. Yet in one sense, in the legend or the image that in the ISKCON, for example, that Srila Prabhupada was presented with, is that, and we've heard stories that sometimes, like, no, actually, the real humility is to defeat the entire universe in Krishna's name, for example, right? So it's kind of like, that's real humility. Now, perhaps I can't say, you know, maybe for someone that could be real humility for them. But for most of us, that's not going to be real humility at all. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not going to be there. It's not going to be real for us. So I guess, and I'm fascinated by this idea, you know, that the history is written by the winners. You know, they often say that. And that becomes the legend. That becomes the stories. That becomes the thing. So I'm fascinated by this idea that for so many years, I noticed it. I don't know if you've noticed it. There were certain stories repeated about Prabhupada, and there were certain pictures used in publications about Prabhupada, and they were all very much of a certain type of story and photo and legend that was created. And then slowly, sometimes over many years later, you start to see these other photos that are totally not like that, and they're much more human and intimate and sort of showing him, you know, not as the invincible superhero. And there's so much more appealing.
There is something in the collective unconscious of the community to make the same more human, more close.
Yeah, well, whether it's but it's almost like, you know, the official story or the official presentation is always, you know, invincible, completely beyond, you know, all of that. And as many conversations have happened, you know, in more recent years around, like, that's a huge disservice to Srila Prabhupada in a way, because it's not even by his own words, it's not who he was. And also, it's an all or nothing strategy. So it entrenches you to have to double down on the simplified, dogmatic, literal stories, because if you don't, your brain is going to melt, because you're going to think, how can I enter into this territory where maybe it's not like that? And so it just entrenches everything in this very immature understanding. And I guess what I, just to hand it over to you in a moment, but I have a personal story. Recently, so my documentary has won many different awards. Recently, it got nominated for the best documentary at what's called the Cannes Film Awards. Now, the Cannes Film Festival, which is on around the same time, is like the pinnacle of all pinnacles of, you know, films. It is.
Like, it's in France, right?
It's in France, but it's like winning an Oscar. It's like huge. Now, I shared my news, and when I shared my news, I knew that there would be some misunderstandings by people. I knew that some people would be confused and think it was the other festival.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I thought to myself, do I start off by qualifying that and sort of apologizing and over-explaining and everything? And I thought, no, I'm just going to tell them what is true. This is what happened.
Yeah.
But I felt extremely uncomfortable at the same time, because I knew that people would misunderstand and assume, and they did, loads of them, say, oh, you know, whatever. In the past, I've tried to explain things like that and stuff, and no one even reads it, and they still have the same misunderstanding. And, you know, so I thought, well, I'm just going to be happy about my news. I'm just going to share it as it is, and it is what it is. But I did feel some responsibility for how I knew it might be misunderstood as well. So in the building of legends, in the building of, you know, these superheroes or these great leaders that we talk about, is there a responsibility on how they tell stories about themselves and how other people tell stories about them, especially after a long time now, that we know that people will build a legend from it that may not be true? Where is that responsibility or not responsibility? And equally, I know, because I've heard from people who were there, you know, and I'm not going to name who it was, but there's a certain leader who would write, you know, stories about what they did, and it would be so fantastical and everything else. And other people who would be there would say, that is not how it was at all. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're adding some spice to the masala.
You're absolutely making it out. And not only that, it's not normal spice. You're adding in the spice of, you know, that we're doing this all in Lord Chaitanya's Leela and everything else, you know. So it's kind of like you're adding in some special, you know, absolute spice. And so is that phrase, don't let anything get in the way of a good story, kind of a good thing or a bad thing? Now, if you're in this kind of one way of thinking, you can go, well, of course, if it's in service of this absolute thing, it's all good. Like, just go for it, you know? But history has shown us that it isn't all good. You know, there's many dangerous and really unfortunate things that can come from overinflating the legend beyond what it is.
Oh, there's a lot there, Ravi. Thank you so much.
Sorry
for sharing.
Not to
apologize. There is a lot in the sense I really appreciate the thickness of the content and so many crucial points, like what makes a legend healing, when does it become harmful, and or how does the idealization of saints contribute to spiritual bypassing in many cases, or why do we need our teachers to be perfect? And what happens when they are not perfect in the absolutistic way? This, as you say, all or nothing approach. I mean, as you may know, recently, maybe weeks or months ago, I published something on Prabhupada, some of Prabhupada's statements about more relative statements about race and woman and other things. And yeah, it stirred the pot, no, of course. Not my intention is not to disturb anyone, but just let's bring to the table the things and from my side is, yeah, I don't feel the need to over-absolutize every single thing that a person that I consider an enlightened being, a pure devotee, it doesn't mean that that person needs to be right about every single thing in every department of knowledge. I don't feel the need to over-absolutize that person. When that person himself is saying, I'm not perfect in everything and this and that. So again, as you say, what drives us to make that story bigger than what it already is? Why that's not enough? Now, why is someone being an enlightened being that is blessing my life? Why do I need to put more pump and make the whole thing like bigger and bigger? And of course, you have in terms of legend and stories this department that is called hagiography. So hagiography are like the biographies of religious figures. And it is generally taken as a given that in those hagiographies there will be extra spice, right? And generally the main figure will be depicted as defeating everyone and being perfect and conquering the world and all sorts of magical things happening, which I'm not saying none of that is true, but also I'm not saying maybe everything of that is true necessarily. Yeah. So as you say, as long as it nourishes my faith and inspires me, I'm okay reading some of those stories knowing even that there is some extra spice, but I'm okay with the extras. I know the purpose of the extra spice, especially in Indian narratives, I must say, and I read this from Sri Vatsa Goswami, who is scholar born in Vrindavan, very traditional. And he will say, in terms of history, not story, but history, in India, they generally are more concerned with bhava, with conveying a certain mood, than with the facts and what actually happened.
Yeah.
So for the sake of conveying the mood, sometimes spices may be added, sometimes a lot of spicing.
Yeah.
So I find no problem in that. I find it even charming, and I find it like it has a purpose in creating an experience which ultimately is real. But I think we should engage with all that at least at a certain point, not needing to deny the extra spice. And okay. And I personally, that's what I like. Now, for example, reading among a few books is a book called The Place of the Hidden Moon. That's a well-known, famous, one of the first pieces of scholarship from in the 60s, 50s about Gaudiya Vaishnavism and related tradition. That speaks about Sahaja and other things, but also speaks a lot about Gaudiya Vaishnavism, but from a purely scholarly perspective. So I like to read that because, of course, a scholar, an academic, which is not even subscribed to my tradition, will share the facts and will be more concerned with history and not with and whenever he or she feels there's an overspicing here, they will make it very clear.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean I will agree with them on everything either, but for me, yeah, it sobers and humbles my approach to the legend, so to say. It puts the legend in context. I don't need Prabhupada or Sri Chaitanya or whomever to be every single thing that is said about them to be.
Yes.
And for me, that doesn't put them any lower in my heart. Actually, in one sense, it makes them even closer because, as you may, it adds this dimension of humanness, of approachability, of relatability. I remember recently I made one of these posts about Prabhupada, and I wanted, because the post was related to some things Prabhupada said about dark-skinned people. So I want to find a picture for the post of Srila Prabhupada with a dark-skinned disciple. And there are a few I came to know, but at the time I was not able to do any. So I dared to create one with ChatGPT. So some people didn't like that, and I can relate to them. But one of the criticisms were like, in that picture, the disciples is too close to Prabhupada, and nobody sit on the same level with Prabhupada ever. So they were taking kind of even like an offense, like, how you dare to do that? And for me, it was, if that's the main reason you oppose, I mean, all those reasons for me are charming, right?
Absolutely. Like, absolutely. Like, the, it's almost like that type of a comment almost, for me, you know, we're talking about this idea of bhav or feeling, you know, it sounds like, you know, that person would love to be in a Victorian classroom where, you know, children are seen and not heard and get slapped across the wrists when they, you know, speak out of line. That's the kind of like, where's the, there's no charm or no love in that to me, you know, that, that is just, you know, almost like, my dad is the best dad in the playground, and how dare you say anything otherwise, you know?
And again, there is a place for that at certain period of development. The problem is when it comes from the higher quarters, quote unquote, that that story, that narrative is like, it's always like that. That can be dangerous. It's a potential cult, potential fundamentalist movement. And we see the worst things in humanity many times done in the name of God, in the name of religion, in the name of this absolutized ideas or legends of, around people. I mean, you can end up doing literally the worst things in the history of humanity in the name of
all
that justified in that.
Because of the certainty. And you know, it's going on today. It's always been going on, like that kind of our land, our people, our, you know, and I actually did an interview on my podcast along, and I asked my guest about this idea of, you know, religious stories. And he said, oftentimes in the direct translations in the ancient texts, people, whoever the people were, they called themselves the people, because in their mind, they were the only people, because those guys are not us. They're the other guys. You know what I mean? So it's in that sense of that a lot of terrible things can happen. But something that's fascinating to me as well is once you, and I understand why people feel the need to hold Prabhupada as pure above all else, because so many other awful things have happened in the name of leaders that presented themselves. So it's kind of like for people, it's like they've had, you know, 10 different rafts and they've all sunk. And they're holding onto the Prabhupada raft, and they just need to convince themselves this raft is never going to sink. And they just desperately need to saying that over and over again, you know, for fear of sinking. So, you know, and obviously Prabhupada has passed away. And in that traditional sense, obviously that raft is not going to sink. But it doesn't mean that, like, I'm going, because this raft is not going to sink, this is the best raft, it's the shiniest raft, it's the most flotatious raft. It's, you know, it sounds like Trump, doesn't it? You know, he just say everything he does is the best, you know? and it's quite amusing in some ways. But it's kind of like, after a while, though, it does get quite tiresome and kind of like a bit of a broken record, you know?
And that sinking begins, the actual sinking begins.
Well, perhaps, yeah. So I often think to myself, there's devotees online, you know, say 5-6 years ago that sort of fell out with me because I started in conversations to say, it's obvious that certain things Prabhupada said about certain things like, you know, race or women or whatever, they were from what he learned growing up in school and everything else. I mean, it's just, it's so obvious. Like, you know, if you try to see it, like, you know, impartially, you know, not everything he heard was from his just like anyone else's understanding of the world was learned through stories. And who are they heard from? Some are heard from the parents. Some are heard from the neighbors. Some are heard from the Gandhi people he was with. Some are heard from his teachers. Some are heard from his friends. Some are heard from his teacher. And they all build up this picture, you know? You know, I like to think about it, and again, it's not in any way to, for a moment, try to be critical, but it's like, Prabhupada himself, or in, at least in the Lilamrita, we hear, Prabhupada did not want to marry the woman that his father wanted him to marry because he did not find her as attractive as the woman that he did want to marry. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's plain and simple as that. I mean, it's there. He was ambitious. He wanted to be successful in business. I mean, you could go on and on. There's so many things that he wanted to do in a very late part of his life. And during his life, of course, he, you know, tried to be connected to the devotees and he'd help them here and there in different ways, whatever way he could. And, you know, he had his own practice and everything else. But other than that, he lived, you know, what would be quite a relative to his cultural context, a pretty normal and full life, you know, with all the desires of those different stages of the life. And then later we get this version of him that came over as an older man, kind of retired from all of that, you know, didn't really have a good experience of family life in his personal experience. And so you, how can you remove him from all of that context? It's actually
like the lost years of Christ, the lost years of Prabhupada.
Yeah, and it's kind of dehumanizing of him. Yeah, like we're robbing him and we're turning him into this deity that we want him to be.
Yeah, like isolating
or brutalizing
him. I remember reading one beautiful book called Our Prabhupada, A Friend to All, which even was not about Prabhupada as a Grihastha, but as a sannyasi before going to the West, which still is different to his world-conquering depiction. So I find that especially charming because it showed him in a more simple life, not still worldly successful, conquering everything as it will be depicted. So I'm saying that just as an extension of what you are saying, like what is... We should include the chapter, but also we should include the rest of his life chapter and try to put all in context, all together, not need to isolate, overemphasize, but see all that as an integration of. And if he ended up doing what he did, nobody denies that, and we are all here as a result of that in one sense. But whatever happened before is also part of the story, so to say, right? So it's interesting for me to appreciate all that and not just say, oh no, that doesn't matter. Or even if there is something that looks too normal, that was a lila.
That was just
a pastime. That was not, or even if he says something that could be taken as relative and that not accurate, the brain size of the woman or whatever. he was testing us actually, but he was always perfect. And again, the real question there is, what makes you need that to be the case? Why your faith needs to over-absolutize everything?
And what are you afraid of? Like, do you think that, like, either way, Prabhupada is Prabhupada, right?
Yeah.
He is what he is. And he did all the things that he did. Mm-hmm. So are you saying that he couldn't have done all of those things if he was, you know, a sort of a normal person? Well, I think in many ways that's actually a far more inspiring story, that he was one of us in a way, and he went on that journey and he did the incredible things. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, we put him out of into a different category than us. There is no hero, because if someone was always going to be a hero and they became a hero, there's no hero. There's no story.
Yeah.
You know, that's one thing.
It's kind of this idea, of a guru is always a nitya siddha, an eternally liberated person. Every guru is always coming from the spiritual world. It's like, that's discouraging because I have no role model to look up for because they already were always perfect. So how can I identify with their journey? And regarding what you said, and I hope you have a few extra minutes for what we accorded originally, 5 more, 10 more.
5 more. Let me send. Yeah, okay. Like
I'm
literally.
I'm just doing my begging, daily begging as a sentence. I was thinking about. I have been studying in more detail a little bit also the life of Bhakti Hriday Bon Maharaj, who was a god brother of Prabhupada, who went to the West before him. And the opinion of some, he was not successful again by comparison of numbers.
But he had huge success. Yeah.
But for me, it was huge success first because he did that with sincere intention of pleasing his guru. So that for me is success. Also, he even if you say only 2-3 devotees or officially initiated devotees came, one of them was Sadananda Swami, who at the end of his life he realized his spiritual identity, one pure devotee. Prabhupada say, if one pure devotee comes, that's success. That's success. And also I was thinking, okay, but he was in Europe during the time of World War. So that's a very different scenario than US and the hippie movement. That was a more, in my opinion, fertile social dynamics. Definitely. So my question then went, what if Prabhupada would have been the one going to Europe during the World War time? Would have created the impact he had when he did it in the US? Probably not. No. I don't know. Probably not. And by saying that, I'm in any way, in my opinion, I don't think I'm downplaying Prabhupada. I don't feel the need to say, no, even if Prabhupada would have gone in the World War II, he will have converted Hitler and the whole Nazi movement. I don't need to say that. And the success that Prabhupada had, of course, he was, again, I consider him a pure devotee, an empowered agent of Nityananda Prabhu, Shakti Abhisa, but I don't deny any of that. But also I will acknowledge there was a particular social zeitgeist, the climate of the time that made the whole thing more prone to that success also, and that plays a role. So I wouldn't just try to, it's all Prabhupada's miraculous empowerment and everything else doesn't count, and everyone else who tried didn't do like him, there's inferior, not successful. Again, it's the all or nothing, black and white mentality I cannot subscribe to. Sorry.
Yes. Yes. And the interesting thing is as well, is if we kind of go back to that thing of, you know, offer me with love and devotion just a flower, some water, some fruit, you know, it's the spirit in which the offering is made. So we often get hung up on the results. So like you said, you know, Bon Maharaj, he also, made friends with, they don't have to become devotees, but like so many intellectuals, and he had so many conversations, and his thought, ideas and presentations were appreciated. And for all we know, you know, those ideas filtered out and those seeds went out.
He was as successful, I would say, as one could be at that particular time and place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Given the circumstances of the time. No? And again, I'm not here trying to defend one and put the one above the other, but there are certain limitations in terms of what the particular times and place in society allows.
For sure. And also we often do it with everybody that's successful. We celebrate the success. But recently I was reading a letter that Prabhupada wrote to Gandhi.
Mm.
And it's interesting. Obviously, certain people will read the same letter and come away with different things. I was noticing some people were going, oh, yeah, just see how Prabhupada was so heavy on him and all this. What I read was, it didn't work. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So not as a criticism, but and there were many letters like that, you know, that he sent out, and so many things that didn't work.
Yeah.
You know, and that's okay as well. Like that's part. And actually, arguably, there's no less devotion in the effort that went into that that didn't turn into anything than something else that did. You know, it's that endeavor, right?
I was reading that day from the Bhagavatam, which says bhakti is so easy and user-friendly that even if you have the sincere intention of pleasing Krishna, that's it. That's success, no matter what's the outer result. So it's so much about the intention of our heart, which is the most challenging thing many times, because it sounds easy, but many times it's easier to get numbers and external success.
Yes.
So we don't have to care for what's going on in my heart.
And actually,
my actual motivations, my intentions, that's a real thing that actually at the end of the day, Krishna can only see, as you quoted from this verse of the Gita, right? Yeah. So I can attain perfection by offering Krishna a little flower, little water with my full heart, and I can make a huge successful project on the outside, but not motivated from the same place that I offered that little flower or heart. So what's impacting more in Krishna's heart? That's the measure of success for us, right?
Yeah. And that's a big irony in our, you know, in our kind of, like, that's the danger of getting into the external, too, into the externals and not embracing the internals. Yeah. Sort of to start to finish up from my side, well, many, many, many devotees have researched and supported my kind of teacher that I got me involved on the spiritual path and I was with for 7 years was a devotee called Tribhuvanath.
I heard of him.
Yeah. And he was pretty amazing, but also, you know, very much a fully rounded human, you know, very much, you know, not perfect, but perfect in his endeavor to please, you know, to serve, but not a perfect person, you know, but he was using what he had very, very sincerely. And so devotees have been writing, you know, working on writing a book, and now I'm working on doing a documentary about his life. And for me, one of the intentions is that if I can present him in the fully rounded way that what it was like to meet him in real life, if the readers can come away, or the watchers can come away feeling like they've been with him in all the aspects, you know, the not just like, I can't remember what you called it when they sort of spice it up, that type of biography, or what was it called?
Hiography,
yeah. So that's, I'm on purpose not going to do that, because I feel like so many times until now in our tradition, that is the way it is, you know, and I don't mean this to sound critical, so please, listeners, understand, I don't mean it like that, but most of those stories start with, you know, he was born on an Ekadashi and this and that. And so you're creating the legend from the first seconds, right?
Yeah. The birds sang in this particular way at that time. And the clock
and the sun was shining through the window. And then there was a shadow on the wall and all of that, you know, like, you know. And the reason why I'm doing that is because I think Tribhuvanath, with all his faults, is still an incredibly inspiring person.
Yeah.
And he doesn't need to be turned into something else. And I want to, part of the offering is obviously to remember him, but also to kind of put it out there in the community of devotees that you don't have to do it in that other way.
Yeah. It reminds me of this beautiful quote from Richard Rohr, who will say, perfection is the inclusion of imperfection. Perfection is not the exclusion of imperfection. For perfection to be really perfect, it has the capacity to include imperfection, to integrate, to give some place to that, right? Mm. So, yeah, I am thinking about that regarding the project you are describing, and also thinking about how many times when we are not willing to include imperfection, what we are saying is, I'm not willing to give myself unconditionally to other person. In other words, I can only surrender and love you if you are perfect.
Yes.
If you are a legend, if you are perfect in every sense, I love you and I praise you. But whenever something comes, some relativity, some potential imperfection, it's all or nothing. And that speaks more about my unwillingness to give myself unconditionally. Because to love unconditionally means you're imperfect and I still love you. And that's how Krishna loves us. That's the thing. We are being loved in that way by God. And we are expected to return the embrace from that same place. But many times we are not willing to give ourselves unconditionally, but conditionally, the condition being you have to be perfect. And we measure perfection as a fixed maximum, absolutistic, and we lose sight of nuance, of humanness, and of the gifts of imperfection as well, right? So
yeah, it's such a powerful point. And I know I know you kind of completed the circle there, but as you were saying the first part that, you know, I can only love you if you're perfect. That means that I also believe that you will only love me if I'm perfect.
Which again,
so then it's hopeless, right? Yes. There's no hope.
Yeah. And probably we think like that still. We still are in this transactional thing. I will only be loved if I'm perfect, unconsciously. So we need to dethrone that. That's why my fourth book that I'm writing is about unconditional love, and to really relax and realize you're already fully loved and accepted. So you don't need to attain that, but now you have to be concerned how to return that to others in the same unconditional way.
Beautiful.
Ravi, I don't want to take more of your time. Two more minutes. I would love to talk about so much. I'm on storytelling. I would like to talk about this idea of also sometimes we have, there is my story, our story, and the story.
Yeah,
that's a different podcast some other day. But I like to finish some of my podcasts by asking a few short questions that require like a very short answer. I call them Ushnena Samapayet. In Sanskrit, we have Madhurena Samapayet. You try to end with something sweet, Ushnena Samapayet. Let's end with something more spicy. We were talking about spice. So some spicy, sharp questions and quick fire responses only. Hot takes, no commentary.
Yeah.
Right? What's one spiritual cliche you wish you would retire? We would retire as a tradition.
That the spiritual master has to be perfect.
What's the most dangerous myth in organized religion?
That the organization is always correct.
What's the most underrated spiritual practice today?
Breathing and just trying to appreciate what's around you.
What's a story from your tradition that you no longer believe literally, but still love? Okay, one which that we you no longer believe literally. I don't know if you love it or not. That may be easier.
I see that there's benefits in the ideas of a Ekadashi, and there's benefits in ideas of thinking about, like, maybe that you may not want to eat onion and garlic, but the stories that are given for both of those things, I completely don't believe.
Okay. Who is a better teacher, the one who bleeds or the one who beams?
Ooh, the one who bleeds.
Mm. What's more dangerous, a story with no truth or a truth with no story?
Truth with no story.
What's one sacred story that still makes you weep?
I guess it would be the Damodar story, you know, how, you know, there's no way that Mother Yashoda can control Krishna except through love and surrender, or also the one where in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, where after so many lifetimes, you know, the soul comes and Krishna embraces them.
Thank you. Can there be a guru without a pedestal?
Definitely.
There's hope. Great. If you could rewrite one part of your tradition's main narrative, what will you change and why?
Embrace the tradition, be humble, and don't be so fixated on it being having to be the truth for everyone else.
And the last one. If there is one, what is the greatest story ever told?
Oh, gosh. It's your own story. For you. You know, because there can be so many other stories, but every story you interface with, it is inherently becoming woven into your story. Because in one sense, the only story that you end up with at the end is your own story. Beautiful. It encompasses all the other stories.
Thank you. Beautiful, sweet spot to put our conclusion there. Thank you so much, dear Ravi, for coming. A great pleasure to share with you today.
Thank you for asking me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.